discussion. You know, based on that. And so, I'm by habit a kind of a news junkie. And so just taking in everything that the news media have had to offer, just over the course of the weekend, you get the sense that we are all going to hell in a handbasket, you know, that things are in a terrible state of turmoil, no one's in control, and we're all circling the drain. Things are pretty horrible. And in fact, we are, at least certainly in my own living memory, facing a sort of a combination of challenges that are, at least the combination is relatively unprecedented in our lifetime. So in our own society, we're looking at a public health crisis, you know, a pandemic that our nation, among the most technologically advanced in the world, has completely failed to handle in a cogent, focused, and effective way relative to other nations of the world at our own state of economic development and technological sophistication. We've just done a massive faceplant as a nation. And as a result, we're facing partial economic collapse. There is caste-based social injustice and radical inequalities, inequities, and wealth and power and opportunity that have just been kind of brought graphically into focus for us. And also the violent and life-threatening effects of climate change. You know, for those of us here in Colorado, especially along the Front Range, we endured this period over the course of the last couple of weeks when both these major fires, fires of historic proportion and intensity here in Colorado, were flooding the Front Range and the Platte River Valley, the Arkansas River Valley, with really life-threatening levels of particulates and precursors of ozone and all kinds of really nasty stuff that it was, you know, the climate scientists have said, I'm sorry, this is what we've been predicting for a long time, and now it's happening. You know, these there are many factors have gone into creating these fires, but among them is climate change is happening faster and more severely than we thought it would. And then, Carl, of course,
excuse me, Carl, yeah. Lloyd, is everybody? Does somebody's mentioned that they can't hear? Is anybody else having problems hearing? Okay. All right. Excuse me.
No. Let me check my own settings and make sure that I've got it right. Yep. Looks like I'm good on my end. Are people mostly able to hear me okay? Oh, Karen and Ken can't. Poorly can.
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Luke here.
And Kathleen, are you good?
I'm good, but I have headphones. I do think Zoom did something with audio. And so we might be experiencing something new.
All right. Well, we'll keep going and see if it gets, you know, any worse, any better. So all this is by way of saying that just in terms of the snapshot of current kind of news input, things seem to be pretty rocky and uncertain and prone to the generation of a sense of anxiety and unsettlement and fear, with a concomitant tendency to kind of withdraw or go within, try to get away from that which is happening. So when I think about all that's going on now, and then I seek to relate that to what we have in common as a Sangha in terms of the teachings and the practices of the Buddha, it's helpful for me to kind of step back just a little bit and to remember the context within which the Buddha taught, you know, how were things during his lifetime? What was it like in the society around him at the time that he taught? And to whom was he speaking about these matters when he taught? I think that as Buddha Dharma has come to the West, I think among the really, really welcome and important, powerful lessons that both the teachings of the Buddha and the practices of Buddha Dharma have been learning how to discover and employ and enrich and strengthen the mind's ability to find peace and to find calm and to find a place of refuge within, and to come together with others who have a similar goal, and to create Sangha, and to co-create places of refuge like our Sangha, like this Sangha, and retreat Sanghas, where we can agree to reside in and recognize and strengthen a place of equanimity and of peace and whatnot. And so there's this inevitable tendency, just as it was in the time of the Buddha. And this is one of the criticisms of the Buddha, of his monastic Sangha at the time. He said, well, you know, and at the time of the Buddha, there was a bunch of stuff going on. There was incessant warfare, and there was social conflict, and the brutal enforcement of a hierarchy of a caste system. And so there is this sense of, well, you guys are just running away. You're trying to go and create some kind of utopia where none of the problems of the world apply. And you're just trying to get away from it all. And one of the things that the Buddha was actually quite clear about over the course of his lifetime and his teaching, whether he was teaching within the monastic Sangha or to householders and to others in the wider world, as he was saying, no, this path is about finding inner peace, a sense of refuge, a sense of the ability to care for oneself in order that one becomes more capable of caring for others, of caring for the world around us. And so for me, it's really kind of important to remember that was a lot of where the Buddha was coming from, is that we don't do this practice. You know, for sure, it's important to be able to find a place of refuge, a place of equanimity, a place of calm, within our own practice, with our own minds when we come together. But what we do is not simply for the purpose of retreat. It's not simply for the purpose of respite, you know. It is kind of refueling, re-energizing, becoming clear on motives and intentions in order to make it possible for us to be in the world in a more kind and caring way. What I want to do is to spend a little bit of time touching on some of the things that the Buddha taught about how to center and care for ourselves in challenging times, in order that we can help make the world a better place to live in. So, one of the things that mindfulness teaches us is that it's really important to name things, to recognize them for what they are. You know, whether it's and I feel these things when I sit, you know, especially, Thich Nhat Hanh said one time, he said, you know, just as important as what we ingest in terms of food and drink and the effect that that has on our state of being is what we ingest mentally. It's what we do and do not choose to read and do not do and do not choose to listen to, because it has a similar effect on how we perceive the world. And so I've really tried to take his words into heart when it comes to my sometimes unfortunate tendency just to absorb all sources of news like a sponge, you know, and allow the tinges of anxiety that inform the writing of those stories to get to my own head. And yet it's really important, I think, to name whatever the feelings are that sometimes overcome us as we deal with the times that we're in. Back in 1920, there's an Irish poet named William Butler Yeats whose writings I kind of resonate with. And he wrote this poem called The Second Coming, and he wrote it right after the end of World War I, when the British and the French had defeated the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East. And having done so, having obliterated the Ottoman Empire, they were in the process of carving up the Middle East into colonial portions, like a Christmas goose, you know? You know, which parts of the Middle East and the and North Africa was Britain going to get, and which parts were France going to get. And he wrote this poem. It said, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. A waste of desert sand is shaped with lion body and the head of a man." The lion was the symbol for the British Empire at the time. "A gaze black and pitiless as the sun. What rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born." I really love that, you know, and the reason is because what it does, it's like when I sing or play the blues, you know, when I'm really feeling down and I get out my resonate their guitar and open tuning and really get down with, you know, some of the old Delta blues. It's like, it's a way to just kind of give voice and flush out and have a kind of a catharsis around all the shit that I'm feeling, all whatever it is. It's just kind of really heavy and nasty and whatnot about what's going on in my mind. It's useful, and I or can be, if you, as long as you don't wallow in it. And so I'm finding the same thing is really true with regard to anything we come across in terms of how we feel about what's going on right now. I think it's really helpful just to go straight at it and say, what am I feeling? Am I feeling despair? Am I feeling anger? Am I feeling rage? Am I feeling impotence? Am I, you know, whatever it is that's going on, just name it and own it and kind of be there with it. And then, you know, it starts to kind of move through you a little bit, right? And after that's happened, I'm talking now about the terms of the Buddha, the Buddha chakra, the Dharma wheel. You know, we have the factors of meditation, of concentration and effort and mindfulness. And then we move into the wisdom factors, you know, looking at all the conditioning that's caused us to have the feelings that we do, and then look to the perspective of wise action, or what are we going to do about it, you know, how we've been conditioned to think about public health threats and partial economic collapse and social injustice in the past, and how have we tended to respond to those things versus how might we respond going forward from the standpoint of what we've learned by virtue of study and practice of Buddha Dharma? How can we bring wisdom and generosity, kindness to bear on what we feel needs to be done going forward? And reflecting on those things, what's really helpful for me is to remember that we are not the first ones to face what it is that's going on right now. And to really, like I was touching on before, to seek to do what we can to, what I seek to do is to put things back into the context of what was going on when the Buddha offered these teachings in the first place. So what was going on in the time of the Buddha was that there was a time of economic plenty. There is a surge of productivity in terms of the agricultural economy. There were all the tribal republics of which the Sakyans were a part were thriving. There's a lot of social ferment because of the relative robustness of the economy. A lot of people were free to go about and engage in spiritual inquiry, just as he was. And yet there were really high levels of social conflict. There were these violent conflicts between clans, between principalities at the lower level. In fact, one of those involves a clan the Buddha was related to is a horrible, you know, conflict that lasted for years, killed hundreds and hundreds of people, and resulted in a lot of war widows, a lot of wounded veterans, and as this war was going on, the Buddha went and spoke to the conflicting parties, and he mediated a peace, and he brought the war to an end. And what that had the effect of doing was that a great number of the combatants on both sides lay down their weapons and took up robes, and they joined the Buddha. They became part of the monastic Sangha. And what that had the effect of doing was abandoning a whole lot of women in their households. And there were a great number of war widows, and they all turned to the Buddha's stepmom. It was his aunt, the sister of his mother, who died a week after giving him birth, and she raised him as her own. And she was evidently quite an awakened and wise woman of her own. And all these women turned to her, and they said, you know, we also wish to become part of the Buddha Dharma Sangha because we've been abandoned, we're destitute. And the story is told in Susan Marcotte's book, you know, The First Buddhist Women. She went to the Buddha and said, you know, we need to be part of the Sangha as well. You helped create this problem, now you need to help resolve it. And so he was at first quite resistant, but his stepmom, working with Ananda, his aide, eventually brought women into the Sangha, which was kind of a big deal at the time because most spiritual communities didn't do that. War was one of the dominant features of life in the time of the Buddha in northeastern India. 200 years after the Buddha died, the Indian Emperor Ashoka, he was the first, he was the monarch, he was kind of like Constantine the First in Europe. He was the person who first united all of the warring principalities into the nation of what we now call India. And he did this about 200 years after the Buddha's death. And there, it was the big fish eating the little fish, and these various principalities or fiefdoms would be conquered, and then they'd join the larger cause. And then there was just this sort of massive battle, to end all battles, in which Ashoka unified India, but at terrible cost. It was one battle in which over 50,000 people were killed. And the story goes that Ashoka was, he prevailed, and he managed to bring all of these hundreds of warring principalities and fiefdoms together into the nation of India, but that it was at a horrendous cost. This one battle resulted in the death of over 50,000 combatants, you know, and they were all strewn about the battlefield. And he looked out over the battle and, you know, over what had just occurred. And it said that he was sickened, that he was made spiritually ill, that he felt that he had done what needed to be done to create a nation and to end armed conflict, but that it had come at a horrific cost, both in terms of human life and also in terms of his doubting the why it was he was doing what he was doing, you know, whether this his cause was worth the cost. And then as he was looking over the battlefield with this sense of dissolution and disillusion that this monk, this Buddhist monk in robes, was making his way through the battlefield. He's on his way from one place to another, and that he would stop and aid those who he could, who were not, you know, who were wounded but not killed. And Ashoka wondered at how somebody could witness the carnage that he was witnessing and yet experience it and be with it with a certain sense of equanimity and with calm regard and with an inclination toward doing good. And so he approached the monk and said, "Well, like, who are you? How is it you are capable of being in the midst of this as you are?" And so the monk began to explain to him some of the teachings of the Buddha, especially the teachings about equanimity and kind regard and not being overcome by greed and aversion. And it's said that that experience transformed Ashoka's consciousness. And he realized that if what he had just finished doing was to have any purpose and meaning at all, it was to make this nation he just finished creating a better place. And so it was by that means that Buddhism became the state religion of India. He was the person, just like Constantine in Europe, made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire. It was Ashoka who made Buddha Dharma the state religion of India at the same time that he literally created India. And so the reason that I tell that story is not that I expect us all to be Ashoka, right? But that there was something about the conscious presence of that monk in the midst of all the conflict that helped bring forth a kinder and a wiser and a more fruitful and constructive society than had existed before. And so when I think about what we're all doing in terms of our individual practice, in terms of our individual understanding of what the Buddha had to offer, in terms of our getting together collectively, I'm reminded that what we are going through in the present moment is heavy. It's heavy in terms of this combination of events, maybe not having been something that any of us have experienced in our lifetimes, at least in this lifetime. But yet at the same time, there have been many times in the past that have been at least as bad or worse than this one, and in which the teachings of the Buddha have endured and have helped make the world a better place to live in. And so the reason I touch on these issues is because I think there remains the potential for us using our own insights, our own understanding, our own practice, turning it toward the good, toward helping solve the issues that we find before us, you know, whichever one we find ourselves most drawn to, whether it's radical social inequality or the climate crisis, economic collapse, contagion. There are myriad ways in which wisdom, compassion and kindness, generosity can be brought to bear on all of these. If we are ready to investigate how we might go about doing that. So anyway, those are the thoughts at the top of my mind this evening that I wanted to share. And I will look forward to listening to what anyone else in our Sangha has to say about any of these, any questions you might have, or any thoughts or reflections you might have that you'd like to share as well. So please.
Hello, Lloyd. It's Luke here. I think your Dharma talk really was addressing the sort of issues we're dealing with. Coincidentally, I took a program with Pema Chodron and Tim Olmsted, and for years I would go to Omega, which is closed, so it was by Zoom, and the topic of the program was welcoming the unwelcome. And how, you know, when things aren't the way we would like, you know, we push it away, and that doesn't help, you know.
No.
It makes it worse, like you talked about. So she talked about using the practices of Buddha Dharma to work with that. So it was, where a lot of us have anxiety and, you know, there's like more of a groundless state. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, will the pandemic end or not? You know, what will happen economically? I mean, most of us here are fortunate that we have enough food and shelter and all that, but there's a lot of people who live paycheck to paycheck, that take care of us the safe way and whatever, that are not in that situation.
What are some of the Buddha Dharma practices that she recommended, you know, to sort of focus on?
Well, what she was focusing on was, you know, through meditation to whatever comes in, you know, like an open field, whether it's good stuff, bad stuff, not to follow the storyline, but just let it be. Like if you're depressed, experience the depression, you know, but don't follow the storyline and just be with it. You know, and that's not to say, you know, if you have serious depression, you need to, you know, go to counseling and maybe meditate.
Sure, of course, right.
Or anxiety and fear and to just, you know, first to, like we do in practice, first to sit it and be in your body so you can, you know, really feel that and be in the present moment. And then the next thing is to open your field of awareness like we do and you say in practice to include all things, but not, you know, and not attached to it. Just let it be. Things come in, things come out, good things, bad things, like that. And, you know, it's like life, we like to think that things are really solid and really it's more like a river. And when we try and hang on to the side of the river, you know, then and try and solidify things, it causes, you know, we get injured or have lots of problems.
Yeah, right. Okay, thank you, Luke. I really appreciate you sharing that, right? And just to learn that there are other Buddha Dharma sanghas and teachers out there that are really kind of with us, that are looking at the same things in the same way. I appreciate that.
Right. There are many correspondences between what you said and what was in the course. Yeah.
Of course. Good. Thank you. So please, anyone else who'd like to share?
So this is Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Yeah.
Among many disturbing things that I've heard, a new one to me this week was that from two sources, one a pretty good friend and one an interview on NPR, I heard people talking about violent response to the tension that they're feeling. And in one case, these are not cells that are planning activities, but it's around in the culture. In one case, a person was so upset about some of Trump's actions that she was involved in a group that was actually talking about, well, what would you do? Would you go as far as being involved in assassination attempts? You know, oh my God. and in another, it was more people just talking vaguely, maybe as we did in the Vietnam era, but vaguely about revolution. You know, what we need is revolution. You know, let's change this. Oh, you know, to me, that's, those directions are so upsetting, and not just through a Buddhist lens. I mean, for many, many reasons. But it just seems so clear to me that it's based on refusal to be with what is. Now, change is needed. We know that in various ways. But that trying to escape it, that's what it seemed to me like. Just get this out of my life, get this person out of my life, get this social situation out of my life, you know, as if revolution in this country is going to stop global warming. No, you know, so many things. So there's a lot of work to do. There are a lot of upsetting things out, trends out there.
Of course. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think one of the things that was going on in the time of the Buddha, he was in his monastic sangha, they were not seeking to foment social revolution, but what they were doing as a sangha was in of itself quite revolutionary, because it was caste free, and because eventually, you know, with the admission of women, there were all kinds of people who were being brutally oppressed in Indian society who became free from that oppression when they joined that monastic sangha. So just the sangha itself, and he had satellite groups, you know, throughout northeastern India, was a way to, by the very means by which these people lived together, was an example of how things could be different. And so I think in any historic political struggle, which I think that we are in the throes of right now as a nation, there are the efforts being put forth by those who wish to maintain the old order, you know, and they're going to use whatever powers and means are at their disposal to try to maintain the order. And then there are those who are intent upon destroying the old order, on, you know, challenging it and disaggregating it and dissembling it, dismantling it. And then there's going to inevitably be some, if they succeed, a lot of contention over what should the new order consist of. And there's going to be a lot of dialogue around that. So I think that in terms of what we may be able to bring to the party, it's not, you know, I think we have our own vision, and, or, you know, at least informed by the Buddha, in terms of policies that are based upon, you know, rationality, intelligence, wisdom, you know, and kind regard, a desire to help each other out, but also the process by which we seek to achieve those goals, you know, of not doing what's possible to avoid demonizing the other, and instead looking for opportunities for collective action, consensus-based collective action. I mean, I think that I think even given the kind of heated rhetoric that you are describing, all it does is, I think, point out the potential for some really interesting and constructive things to happen if the opportunity presents itself to do so. I can't, you know, as I look at everything that's going on right now and try to make sense of it, you know, what I find really helpful, and I've, you know, as a law and public policy scholar and whatnot over the years, and teacher, you know, I'm pretty relatively well steeped in American political history and whatnot. But when I think about how to really try to get my head around what's going on right now, I'm finding that to some degree, that knowledge is less relevant and important than knowledge of the Buddha Dharma, you know, especially the Buddha's teachings around karma and vipaka. You know, as we've discussed in the Sangha before, we tend to, the dominant uninformed Western notion when you hear about karma is like, well, that's all about, you know, experiencing the consequences of past actions. And in fact, the literal meaning of the words in the traditional Indian context, in both Pali and Sanskrit, karma only means action. It means the seed planting action. It means the intention, combination of intention, whether it's beneficial or malevolent, the combination of intention and the action itself. And then the fruition of the action is called vipaka, right? And so now it's helpful for me a lot of the time to say, you know, even whether it's, you know, the entire West Coast being on fire or a contagion that we do not have the social values of the importance of collective action to effectively counter, you know, doesn't seem to be in the nature of our culture to be able to do that, you know, that this is vipaka. We're experiencing the consequences of the actions of our elders. We are experiencing the consequences of the intentions and the behaviors of everybody, the slaveholders and the slaves and everybody who helped bring this nation into being and to be what it is today. We are experiencing the consequences, the fruition of all that. And, you know, we've experienced the beneficial fruition, especially those of us who live lives of privilege for a long time without even knowing it or thinking about it. And now all of a sudden, we are experiencing the vipaka, you know, of radical social inequity. We're experiencing the vipaka of 2 centuries worth of the exploitation and reliance upon fossil fuels, and the absolute havoc it's wreaking on our global environment. We're experiencing the vipaka, the consequences of all the suffering, you know, all the actions that have created the suffering that we're undergoing right now. And we as practitioners of Buddha Dharma, I think, understand more than others that these are not things to feel guilty about or to feel even woebegone or feel afflicted by or victimized by, but simply to realize these things that we call catastrophes, multiple challenges that we're experiencing right now, are nothing more than the naturally occurring consequences of the actions that we as a culture and as a society have committed in the past. You know, whether or not it's things we individually agreed with or not, but that now as a culture and as a society, we are collectively experiencing the consequences. And just as is the case with recognizing the consequences of individual actions and, you know, speech and actions, especially those that were unskillful, and how it's created suffering in their present day, it's like, oh, right, here we are. Here we are as a group. Here we are experiencing the effects of these actions that were taken by our elders and our forebears, you know, and we're awakening to them, and we recognize the suffering they've created, and we recognize the need for those behaviors to come to an end. The more of us awaken to that, the more of us who speak to each other about that, whether it's, you know, within the confines of, you know, Buddha Dharma Sanghas or the wider world, other faith communities, everybody out there who is awakening to the consequences of our behaviors, you know, they're waiting for us to join them in common cause and create a new vision for how things need to be. At least that's why I remain sort of hopeful, you know. I think my hope is based as much on the Buddha Dharma as it is on anything I've learned over the years about law and public policy. Thank you.
Thanks.
Other stuff, please. Well, if there isn't anyone else who wants to come forth with pearls of wisdom to share, I think it's okay for us to thank each other for our presence and for our practice and for our kind regard for one another and for the world. And for our dedication to use our insights and our good intentions to help make this world be a better place to live in. So let's take just a moment, if we can, to find our sitting posture. And relax into it and allow the eyes to gently close, the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Bhava tu sava mangalam, rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava nubhavena sava sati bhavantuti. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhava tu sava mangalam, rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava dhamma nubhavena sava sati bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhava tu sava mangalam, rakam tu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sava Sati Bhavantute. By the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Everyone, please stay safe and be well. And I'll look forward to seeing you again in another couple of weeks. Sweet dreams.
You too,
Lloyd.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Okay, just sign off.
Hey, Lloyd, what would you like to call the talk?
Maybe equanimity in interesting times. Thanks, Luke.
Okay, thank you. Hey, Kathleen, somehow the recording, maybe the battery was low, sort of kicked out. Did you recorded it on Zoom?